If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
2 years ago, the last citrus orchard, Orange Grove, was purchased and is going to be developed. And I believe that was about 35 acres. And that was in Woodland Hills. And so our property here at Moraga in its entirety is about 16 and a half acres and 7 1/4 are planted to vineyards.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 596. This week we feature Paul Worson, winemaker at Moraga Bel Air Estate, Los Angeles. California is one of the most fertile states for agriculture in the U.S. Wine grapes have been happy to grow in the Los Angeles area, but today, vineyards are few. Paul Worson is winemaker at Moraga Bel Air in L.A., and along with the collection of chickens and such, farm life can be found right in the city. I caught up with Paul back in April to talk about this unique wine-growing property. Please forgive the chickens in the background, as they are only trying to get some of their 15 minutes of fame. You can also hear Paul on our Vino Lingo segment defining the phrase wine appreciation. I'm on the phone today with Paul Worson. Paul is the winemaker, and I'm going to try and pronounce this correctly. It is Moraga Vineyards. Is that right?
Yes, Moraga Vineyards, just like the town in Northern California.
There you go, first try. That's very rare for me. Paul is in Los Angeles on the property, and we're going to get to that in just a few minutes. But good morning to you. How's everything going?
Everything's great. Actually, I'm, like you stated, I'm on property. I'm outside. It's a partly cloudy day. It's about 59 degrees, and I can't hear the freeway. So it's wonderful.
Yeah, that's got to be a good feeling. Partly cloudy. That's not super common, really, there in that area, is it?
You know, it's become more and more common. We've gotten, almost 38 inches of rain this year.
Wow.
Which isn't all that common, but we got 46 last year, which was even less common. So, you know, in terms of weather these days, I think what we now see as less common is going to become more common.
Yeah, that's not surprising. The vineyard is in the Santa Monica Mountains, and so you're just really right above Los Angeles, correct?
We're more right in the heart of Los Angeles. So if you're for you and for any of your listeners who are familiar with L.A., we are directly opposite the Getty Museum, and in the Sepulveda Pass is what separates us. And in addition to the Sepulveda Pass, the 405 freeway also happens to go right through the Sepulveda Pass. So we have Santa Monica being, I think it's 5 miles to the ocean from here. Downtown L.A. is to the southwest by 15 miles or so. And then the San Fernando Valley is what's north of us on the other side of the Sepulveda Pass. So, no, we're kind of in the thick of it. The lower elevation of the property is 30 feet above sea level. And the peak of the vineyards is at about 870, I think it is. So we're really not above Los Angeles, say like the observatory at Griffith Park. That certainly sits above Los Angeles. Yeah, that's a short answer.
That's okay. I'll scold you if I have to, trust me.
Yeah, yeah.
Some time ago, I was reading about that particular part of California, and long before there was the whole sprawl of all the cities and towns and et cetera, that was considered a real prime area for grape growing. Is that accurate?
Actually, Los Angeles is a really prime area to grow everything. You know, back in the 1800s, well into the 1940s, you know, it's the 1894, I think there were somewhere just shy of, just over 200,000 acres of grapevines between L.A., Orange, and I think that year they excluded Ventura and San Diego, Riverside and San Bernardino. But Los Angeles and Southern California were the breadbasket in the produce department for a large part of the country. The San Fernando Valley was citrus orchards and lots of small family farms. The West Side, Santa Monica, lots of vegetables, sandy loam soils, great climate. Yeah, before the sprawl, it was agriculture.
Is there much left in the way of vineyards at all?
No, there's fewer and fewer. Actually, 2 years ago, not vineyards, but the last citrus orchard, orange grove, was purchased and is going to be developed. And I believe that was about 35 acres, and that was in Woodland Hills, Calabasas area. And so our property here at Moraga in its entirety is about 16 and a half acres, and 7 1/4 are planted to vineyards. There was upwards of 100 acres still in L.A. County, but with the wildfires that we've been having, the one in 2018 that started in Simi Valley, that wiped out the lion's share. I think that took out like 60 acres of vineyards in total.
Man, that's just sad.
Yeah, very sad. And a lot of people, you know, because these were homes and not commercial enterprises, their homeowners insurance didn't cover it. They got something like $14 or $10 as a replacement cost for landscaping is what the insurance companies determined it to be. And some of these properties have steep slopes, and they're difficult to tend to, and the cost of removal and replacement is somewhat upwards of $75 a vine. So
that money would pretty much cover the cost of a stapler, I'd say.
Yeah, actually, it covers the cost of the vine itself. Vines are about $7.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, man, that's just such a challenging way to run a business. Well, as far as the property, and obviously many people are familiar with the climate of Los Angeles, but do you have some of the same effects of fog that you see in Northern California at all? I mean, that's an ignorant question on my part, but...
No, it isn't in any way. We do have fog. Ever since I was a kid, everyone always talked about the June gloom. May and June are typically foggy months in Southern California. And in July, there's less and less fog. Here, because of our proximity to the ocean, we get a little bit more fog than, say, the San Fernando Valley or Universal Studios. But in Northern California, they get their fog in the mornings in the summertime, the proper summertime, July, August, and into harvest in September. And June is typically a very sunny month up there for Napa and Sonoma. So we have to farm a little differently because of that.
I do want to take a moment aside here. You had mentioned when we first got on the phone that there'll be some background noises so our listeners could understand, because you're really an operating ranch. What do you have going on? You have chickens? What else?
We have chickens. We have bees. We have 7 beehives on property. Maybe it's 8. We had a swarm come onto the property last year, and we were able to rescue it. And then we have an organic vegetable garden for the owner, and then the crew, they maintain their own garden on the property: peppers, tomatillos, cilantro, onions, tomatoes, and a variety of other corn. There's always corn. Oh yeah, and I'm looking at it right now. The sugarcane plant. So, and in addition to the 7 1/4 acres of vines.
What a great place to go to work. And again, we're very clearly got one little guy that wants to get on the podcast in the background. I mean, he's definitely going to make his debut.
Yeah. They're very entertaining.
Yeah. I'm getting that already.
Yeah.
So, I want to get to the wines here. I've been able to sample one of the two wines that were sent to me. It was a red, and, it was an interesting wine because I cracked it probably about an hour and a half before I sat down to eat. And at first it was kind of like, okay, this is okay. And about a half hour into it, it was one of those classic wine experiences where it's like, man, this is good.
Yeah. May I ask what year we sent you?
2017.
17, okay. So yeah, in our origin, we were modeled after a red Bordeaux house or a house in Bordeaux. We have a red wine that is a blend of Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Petit Verdot, and Cabernet Franc. And then we have our white wine. While it is not a blend, it is of Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon. It is 100% Sauvignon Blanc. And their styles. much like a red Bordeaux and a white Bordeaux. And with that, you know, the wines are a little tight upon release, and they need a little bit of time to settle down and really come into their own. And it's not atypical to, yeah, I had a conversation with somebody just last night who sent me a picture of a wine, and they said they were going to decant it, and they thought they were going to upset me. Actually, this was my daughter, my oldest daughter. And I said, yeah, great, good for you. You know, last time I spoke and did a presentation with George Riedel, he decanted everything except for sparkling wine. He decanted just because, you know, it's fun. It's a display and it's showy, and there's no harm in that.
Are you not of the ilk that would want to decant your wine? I'm just curious.
Oh no. I think for the right wines, I think decanting is vitally important. In my former lives throughout the rest of California, you know, after a certain age, you know, red wines definitely benefit from decanting and a little bit of air, in as much as for as much as 2 hours or so before. And it's a great way to get the wine off the sediment. I mean, no one wants that floaties, for lack of a better term.
Sure, right.
It'll get on their teeth, or that will affect your experience of the wine. So no, go ahead, decant it, white or red.
Sure. No, I was just curious about that because obviously many winemakers have different opinions. I'm going to backpedal for one quick second before I forget. Moraga, the name, where did that come from?
Oh, it came from the Winipero Serra when he was coming through and establishing the missions. And so, yeah, there's actually at the front or the entrance of Moraga Drive, there's actually a memorial, basically, for De Portola, who traveled with the Spanish missionaries. And yeah, and so Moraga is also the name of the street that the property is on. And so, no, it goes back to the 1600s.
Yeah, we have a lot to be grateful for with all the missions that were built along the coast, because we may not even have this wine if it weren't for them.
Yeah, we could say that.
Well, let's talk about you and your background, Paul. I always like to ask that question. I'm sure you get asked this about 200,000-300,000 times. But, you know, what was your moment that took you into wine? When did it get its grip on you?
You know, I was a student at UC Davis. I was under the false impression that I wanted to go into medicine like my father. And and in my third year, I was an entomology major, and I started brewing beer with my roommates and some friends. And, you know, the beer bug is what bit me first. And I decided to get credit for unrestricted electives while learning how to do my hobby better. And then I decided to change my major from entomology to fermentation science. And back then at Davis, if you wanted to make pharmaceuticals or beer or wine or yogurt or soy sauce, that's what your major was. They now have a dedicated viticulture and enology major. They started that, I think, a year or two after I graduated. Between my fourth and fifth year, I did an internship at Gloria Ferrer, the sparkling winery in Shellville in Sonoma. And, you know, at the end of the season, when we were all going to go back to school and the winery was going to go about its regular work, the winemaker held a meeting with everybody, full-time and part-time people, and he talked about what harvest was like and where he thought things were going and where they were now. And then as he was talking, I reflected upon my own experience with the different vineyards and the fruit and the juices. When I started, I was just supposed to be a cellar hand on the swing shift. I ended up becoming in charge of the crush pad, because someone's visa didn't work out from Spain, and they were sent back home. And so I knew the different vineyard blocks, and I knew what the juices were and were like when they came in, and the wines, the resulting wines that were made. And as he was going on and kind of wrapping up, I thought to myself, you know what? I want to be that guy. I want to be wine making the decisions for things like this. This is far more interesting than beer. Believe me, I used to love beer. It kind of sticks now to a little too much in my middle. So I don't drink as much beer as I used to, but all the variables that go into making wine and from picking from and now seeing the other side of it, growing the fruit, you know, for me as a winemaker, you know, I look at my job as being, or my responsibility is, number one, not to screw things up, and number two, to make wine that is identifiable 1 year to the next. So whatever came out 5 years ago should taste like what's in the barrel now, and then what's growing on the vines this season, which, you know, the vines are just coming out of dormancy right now. Beer, once you have a good recipe, you can make it forever. But it's the inherent challenges to make wine that's identifiable is being cut from the same cloth year after year after year. And it's kind of been my unintentional specialty to work at and for estate wineries.
And you've worked for a number of other wineries before you came to Moraga. Where else have you worked? I believe I see a note in regard to Australia here.
Yeah, so let's see. When I graduated... they invited me back at Gloria Ferrer, and then from there I went to Maryville and worked with Bob Levy, and then I took some time off to go to Mardi Gras and find the perfect job, and I thought that was at Newton Vineyards back when it was owned by Peter Newton and Suwah, but, you know, John Kongsgaard left that season, and there was a whole bunch of stuff going on, so I cashed in a few chips and called up a few friends, and I went to Australia and worked for Rosemount Estate in New South Wales back when it was still family-owned. So I did harvest there and worked for 3 months, and then I traveled throughout the country for 3 months. And then upon coming back, Chateau Patel, back then it was a small winery up on Mount Zeder, they were looking for help, and so I got a job with them. I was with them for 2.5 years. And one of the longest tenured employees in production that they ever had. But they're very good people. From there, I went to Trefethen Family Vineyards in the Oak Knoll District of Napa Valley, and I was there for 9 years. And then in 2009, you know, my wife and I were both from the L.A. area, and we wanted to be closer to family. And, you know, I owe a lot to my friends. A little bird whispered into my ear to float them my resume, and two interviews by proxies later, I was sitting in the Sebastiani Vineyards offices with Bill Foley, who owns Foley Family Wines. And I think 26 wineries now, maybe it's only 24, here in California and Washington and New Zealand, and along with a few strategic relationships with wineries in Europe and in South America, Chile. And yeah, I was with Foley Family Wines for 9 years as well before returning to Los Angeles to care for sick family.
That's a very serious career. May I ask how many vintages you have under your belt at this point?
I think 33. I think it's 33, but it could be 32 or 34. You know, there were with going below the equator, and then doubling up vintages with sparkling wine and still wine. It could be as low as 32 or as high as 34, but it's been a while since I did the math.
No, still, that's a good amount. Well, with all that in mind, do you have one particular mentor or maybe a couple who's really been sort of the shining light for you in your career?
You know, a couple, yeah. You know, Bob Swain, he took over. He'd been the cellar master at Clos du Val for 20-some-odd years, and they had a purge, and he ended up taking over for John Kongsgaard at Newton Vineyard that year. And you know, from him, I learned how to manage people. I've worked for many winemakers and owners who aren't exactly the most encouraging. He was a great guy to work for and work with. You know, at Marquette Formeau, with Chateau Patel, you know, through her, you know, I really developed my palate And really, she impressed upon me the importance of kind of more old world style winemaking, and that it's okay to get your hands dirty. And the style of wine that they made there is very similar to the style of wine that we've been making here at Moraga for 30 some odd years. And Philip Shaw, he was the winemaker at Rosemount Estates. You know, there are, I don't want to say a few tricks that I learned from him, but, you know, there's no better way to put it. You know, it's, you don't have to think so linearly with wine, and it's okay to kind of buck a trend. And then for grape growing and viticulture, Tom Prentice, he's the owner and or partner and CEO of Crop Care and Associates. Up in Napa and Sonoma, if you don't have David Abram working with you on your property as a consultant, it's Tom Prentice and his guys. Yeah, you know, just I worked with him at Chateau Patel and Trefethen, and I was fortunate enough to be able to work with him at Foley Family Wines because he was their consultant. And so I have a 20-plus year relationship with him. And you know what? It's, again, you know what? There's the script, and you need to learn when to deviate from it and when it's appropriate. I made the comment about, you know, those unusual climatic occurrences that we've been having here in, I'll say, specifically Southern California. Things we wouldn't normally see are kind of becoming a trend with our climate. And again, there's the script, and then there's when you need to deviate from it. And that's kind of like winemaking as well. You know, I've always thought of winemaking as more like sailing, tacking. You can only go as far as the wind will take you before you need to change direction. And that's agriculture.
Yeah, that's a really good metaphor. Interesting. What other things are you dealing with? You know, we were talking earlier about the more clouds than which you've had in the past. What are other things that you're seeing over the last few years that are different than what you've experienced in the past?
You know, our summers have become a lot more extreme, the temperatures that we see. We saw that for a few years when I first moved here to L.A. in 2017. And we're still seeing those extreme temperatures, but on the whole, you know what, the climate is kind of becoming a little slightly more mild. Winters are becoming a little bit more extreme. We're getting more rainfall. I'm not going to say we're getting three seasons here in L.A. I mean, winter is always a prolonged fall, but just with rain. But yes, spring and fall are far more mild than they used to be, meaning they're just cooler. And you know, it's funny. You know, I try to be observant, and you know, here in L.A., since we've moved here, you know, the leaves of the deciduous trees, those that go dormant, like sycamores, you know, their leaves start turning usually in the middle of August, when they used to turn in October. So there's something triggering the trees to kind of shut down earlier. And I'm not quite sure what that is. But I think it's just the variability in our climate.
Yeah, it's things I guess we're going to have to get used to, but it's interesting to hear from your point of view. I'm going to take a totally different tack here. You can think about this for a moment, but, you know, people always offer professionals advice. And, you know, sometimes that advice might be a little bit on the crazy side, but have you ever been given, and this could be from a winemaker or just from somebody that just came into the winery at one time, any kind of advice that you kind of looked at thinking, well, either they're crazy or I'm crazy?
Gosh, that is an interesting question. Actually, I had one owner who once told me, I was doing a seminar on Riedel glasses, and they told me not to make a joke about the Libby glass, the one with that has the rolled edge to it, as opposed to the Riedel that have the cut edge. And they advised me not to make a joke like I did. And you know, it was from ownership, and she was known for not being very nice. And so there was that. But then, but to kind of take it in another direction, I've been given, advice from customers. We make a red blend here, and I have made red blends just about every place I've worked as winemaker, as assistant winemaker, or associate winemaker. And when you publish the blend, and you have people who follow it from year to year to year, you know, the advice that they have to offer about the current release upon their first tasting it, and that, you know what, they really liked the blend 3 years prior when there was 5% more Merlot and we really should have gone in that direction again.
Of course.
You know, that's advice and I need way too often. So that, there's that.
That's a good one. Oddly enough, I've never heard that one, but boy, I can believe that. This has become my favorite question to ask winemakers. You do plenty of media. You talk to all kinds of people, whether it be at dinners or in a tasting. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
You know, when I'm doing dinners, when I'm doing this or that, and I've got a group in front of me, I usually start by asking how everyone is today. I've never been asked that. I've never been asked, how are you doing today?
Really?
Yeah. As a winemaker, having to entertain people and be on, I call it the dog and pony show.
Sure.
You know, and this is, you know, what we're doing now, I feel is far more intimate, and it's more of as social discourse as opposed to people coming to watch the monkey dance, so to speak. They come for the wine, they come to be entertained, they come for the experience, and it's more like watching a movie than having an exchange. And so, yeah.
That's really a great answer, and I like the monkey dance concept because it truly does become that, doesn't it?
It does. And that's not to say that I don't enjoy it, but it is
sure
and can be extraordinarily exhausting.
Sure, yeah. Paul, I understand you also have your own brand, oddly enough called Warson Wine Company. What a surprise on that particular name. What are you doing on your own?
Yeah, I'm making wines, I'm making varietals that I like and enjoy in styles that I like and enjoy to drink. You know, I'm working with vineyards in the San Ynez Valley and Santa Barbara County, predominantly, that I didn't have access to working for Foley Family Wines. And but because friends managed it or owned it or have a working relationship with the owners, I was kind of given access to it when friends learned that I was starting a project on my own. I'm also making wine from Los Angeles as well. I have a Los Angeles County Rosé, and then I've got a Cabernet Sauvignon. It's actually going to end up becoming a red blend, a Bordeaux blend in barrel. And, you know, being from L.A., having returned to L.A., and making wine, having my own brand, it was important for me to represent and be part of the long agricultural history that we have here in Los Angeles.
Interesting. Yeah. And I like how your rooster in the background got part of that in there. That was good. Well, like I always say, most importantly for our listeners who'd like to learn about you as well as Moraga Wines, what is the website?
The website for Moraga is moragabelair.com. And mine is warsonwine.com.
Great. And that's spelled Warson, correct?
Yeah.
Great. Paul, this has been a lot of fun talking to you, especially with your audience in the background. I've totally enjoyed hearing them. They crack me up. And as we know, chickens and roosters can be pretty fun to watch them run around. I thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And I had a lot of fun talking with you.
Learn more by visiting moragabelair.com. Thanks for listening. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2024.